contributors to our success. As a community partner, your organization or business becomes invested in a richer way in KPFT and helps to keep local independent media flowing. Interested in being a community partner? Well, contact us by email at partners@kpft.org. Thanks for your interest in our Community Partners program. This is KPFT Houston.
Beat of Ray Lynch's Clouds Below Your Knees signals 8 p.m. Thursday and time for So What's Your Story? The only program originating in Houston devoted entirely to storytelling. And it's right here on listener-sponsored KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston. I'm your host, Mary Edgerton, along with an ensemble of gifted hosts. Hank Rubicek, our producer and the show's founder. Greg Audell, appearing with Floyd the Wonder Dog, and Warren Holloman, our master of wellness. These guys are not only gifted hosts, they are also great storytellers. Now, as you know, the station has been closed since the start of the pandemic, and we are flying solo, so to speak, with respect to having an engineer with us. That has been a challenge, one of many. Speaking of challenges, my guest tonight is Banke Awupitu. Banke moved to Houston a couple of years from Rochester, New York. She's a writer, a novelist, a folk and word artist, and the winner of the last live Houston Story Slam in March. Banke, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure. You did tell a wonderful story at the Moth about challenge, and here we are in these challenging times. Can you tell us that story again? Share it with us.
Certainly can. Interesting enough, that performance, I'll say, right, which really wasn't a performance. It was just solely telling a story on stage. That was the last major performance I've had since, right, the pandemic started. The thought of having over 1,000 people in the same room now seems like almost completely foreign. But it was a marvelous moment, and so I shall regale you all with my tale. So I am Banke Awupitu, and as you can imagine, having a name like that has been a bit of a challenge my whole life. The first day of class, role, anytime people call me, they call me Bangy, Bank. They don't know whether I'm a man or a woman, which sometimes works in my favor. But I am kind of equipped and built for challenges. As a first-generation Nigerian, my last name, Awupitu, the translation loosely means warrior. And so when I left Rochester, New York in 2017 and decided that I was going to enter a new season. In prior seasons, I had been an educator and working primarily with activists. When I moved to Houston, I decided to wave my artist flag freely. I had been studying this book called The Artist Way. Studying is the wrong word, more like following this program called The Artist Way, which really takes you through the process, the courage, the bravery, the evolution of admitting that you're an artist, because each and every one of us, we're all artists. We were created by the ultimate artist, and as such, we are to create. So this program will have you writing 3 pages in your journal every day, and you have to take yourself out once a week on an artist date. And as you start to do these things, you'll start to slowly kind of, move from being a caterpillar to a butterfly, just to use a very simplistic metaphor, so to speak. So when I moved to Houston, I was out of the larva phase. My wings were spreading, and I was ready to walk fully as an artist. One of the encounters I had was I was at the convention center, and people never believe me when I say this, but to my core, I'm an introvert. So whenever I have to spend a lot of time with extroverted activity, it drains me. So I was at this big convention at the convention center, no surprise there. And I'm like, this is too much. Let me go outside and kind of refuel. As I'm sitting there, there was a man, young man playing a guitar and another on the trumpet. And their music was so powerful. And I was just sitting there cross-legged. So, you know, I'm trying to get my Gandhi on and kind of this meditative state. And then the Holy Spirit is telling me, get up and dance. And I'm like, oh, I'm going to look crazy. I can't. And eventually I just threw all my stuff down and I just started dancing like with my whole heart and soul. And when it was over, the guitarist was crying. The trumpeter was like, oh my God, I've been seeing this in my mind for so long. I've been wanting to play to a dancer. And then that was like, is when the tide turned, so to speak. I started performing everywhere 4 times a week, no matter what. My niche is, you know, I'm a poet, a spoken word artist, but I would incorporate live music. I would have these dance intros. I was doing things that people had not seen before. And again, I was inspired by this book, The Artist Way, and being true to who I am. And also I had read the collected autobiographies of Maya Angelou. And as you all know, she was a consummate storyteller, performer, dancer, singer, poet. And I decided, well, I'm tone deaf, so I can't do the singing, but everything else I would do. And as I was doing this, I was running into a lot of conflict on these stages, because 7 out of 10 stages in Houston, well, I would say honestly, 8 out of 10 stages in Houston are ran by a man, and 7 of those 8 are ran by an F boy. Now, I can't say the word. I've been told, I've been warned, okay, that there are 7 words I cannot say in the radio, but you guys know what that F stands for. And the definition of an F-boy is a man who uses his privilege to toy upon the emotions and the natural tendencies of a woman to get what he wants. Now, some would argue that some women are F-girls because they do the same, but I'm not here for that argument. I'm talking about the F-boys today, okay? So I was having constant conflict trying to get on stage, and I was like, you know what? I'm going to put on my own show. Another wonderful woman performer, I asked her one day, like, how do you deal with this all the time? And she's like, you got to do your own, right? So, okay, I'm going to put on my own show. But then I was scared because I'm not from Houston. Do I know enough people to sell this thing out? Is it going to be a flop? Are people going to understand the vision? And a friend of mine told me, if anybody can do it, you can do it. You go everywhere and you talk to everybody. And I was like, really? I do? And so I started going through my phone and realizing that I had actually talked to everybody. So many text messages from 713 numbers, 832-281, because as an introvert who does a lot of extroverted activities, I always try to make personal contact or connections with people. That's what keeps me sane as I'm networking, so to speak. And so if I have a conversation with somebody and they tell me that they're really into coffee or whatever, then I might come across a, you know, one of a kind coffee brand. And then I would say, oh, and just send them a text message. So these connections were real. And so when I started asking people to, when they come to the show and everybody's saying, yeah, but you never know, people will tell you anything, right? So the day of the show, I'm in the wings. I have my musicians, I have dancers, I have singers, we have lights. This is a full production, all right? Because I'm from Rochester, New York, and we don't play around. And so I had invested so much in this, and I'm like, oh my God, are people going to be out there? I had no way of knowing. And what do you guys think? Do you think it was like crickets, or do you think it was sold out? You know it was sold out. Come on now. You see this radiance. It was awesome. We blew a hole in the roof that day. It was so much fun. The show was called Queen, A Poetic Journey. And so I told the story of having the bravery to leave my hometown, to leave a marriage that wasn't bad at all. I was actually married to my best friend, but it just was not the life that I had seen in my mind for so long. And so here I am. I won my very first Moth event. I didn't even know what Moth was when I was there, but we'll get to that story later. I met the lovely Mary, and now I am here to tell you all this tale. And this is where the at-home audience collapses and snaps. Thank you.
That was wonderful. Actually, I can't wait for this pandemic to be over, because I'd like you to have another performance.
Right. I get a repeat
and dance. But I'll have to say something about that Moth event. So Hank Klubicek is our the show's founder and our producer.
Hi, Hank.
And Hank was at the show. I remember seeing Hank, and I was there, and what, 1,000 people. And that was a Tuesday. And by Saturday, Hank was sick. And it turns out that he had COVID. And he's spoken about it before on the radio, so I can say something about it. Hank was very sick, and it was very scary. So there was a whole challenge to overcome there of worrying about Hank, and then Hank finally getting better. And of course, he's done several shows since then. But the one that that was the beginning of the challenge, it was a turning point. It was a pivot. There was this wonderful moth with the theme of challenge. And then there was this pandemic. And then the whole world just pivoted to our virtual reality that we're living right now. So your challenge was fun and exciting. And yet some challenges, such as the one we're living in right now, are scary and challenging because of the lack of contact. Have you had a scary challenge?
I have, and it's similar to the challenge that we're encountering now, right? Because coupled with the pandemic is the unsettling that our nation has felt. It's kind of like tectonic plates, right? So we have this foundation of racial hatred, just to cut to the the core of matters, and now all those things are bubbling to the surface. And of course, this isn't the first time, right? We typically have 50-year cycles of this. And so when Black Lives Matter first kind of was coined and was really taking footing, you know, that was at the end of President Obama's tenure. And so in Rochester, New York, we have one of the highest homicide rates per capita, one of the highest poverty rates per capita. It's a beautiful, beautiful city. It's nestled in the Genesee Valley Gorge. Rochester is like an hour away from the Canadian border. We get four seasons. Lots of greenery. So it's 6 hours away from New York City. So it's not that dense, crowded place that you imagine when you think of New York. Rochester is the third largest city in the state. So there's more room. You know, there's high home ownership, but it's a part of the Rust Belt. So we face our fair share of challenges. And then also when Black Lives Matter started, because Rochester has always been a hub of progressive racial reform, such as Frederick Douglass and the North Star, the Underground Railroad. So when Black Lives Matter started, of course, we had a hub of activity in Rochester as well. So in 2016, Philando Castile was murdered. And there have been so many of these murders and so many hashtags, but Philando Castile was particularly disturbing because he did everything right. So he was a licensed gun owner in Minnesota. He was pulled over. And as you're supposed to do, when the officer asked him if he had a gun on him, he said, yes, I do. His hands are on the wheel. His, I believe she was his fiance, was to the right of him. And their daughter was in the car seat in the back seat. The police officer ended up shooting him dead. And as he's dying in the front seat, you know, his fiance is screaming and crying, and the officer is just talking to her as if she's not a human. And their daughter is in the back seat. And so this video went viral. And when it comes to challenges that are what's going on in the nation in regards to social media and the way the algorithm works, certain people don't see the same things as other people, right? But if you are non-white, or if you're a white person who is woke, or you make it your business to be aware of certain issues, you click on certain things and this is what's coming in your feed, right? So you're being inundated. We're being inundated with the heinous act, the heinous murder, to be frank. We're being inundated with the trauma of seeing that. We're being inundated with imagining what life is going to be for this 3-year-old girl who was in the back seat and saw her father murdered at the hands of police who did nothing illegal, nothing wrong. You imagine what life is going to be for his fiance. So even in the midst of watching the love of her life die, she has to be completely stoic and compliant so that she doesn't get killed so she can live for her daughter. We're watching this. So when this happened, I can't even describe the amount of grief and vicarious trauma we were feeling. So we lived in an area, my ex and I, that was close to downtown where a lot of the protests were happening. And, you know, so throughout the day, he would kind of step out and join. And every time he came back, he would just be so rattled at, again, what just happened. But then also the police's response as they were coming into contact with protesters, it just seemed so callous. It seemed evil. And I was like, I don't know. I don't think we should go then. Let's do something completely different. Let's celebrate life. Because if we're saying that Black Lives Matter, which of course they do, then we have to not be afraid to embrace joy and say when it's too much. So we decided to go to a co-ed baby shower of two of our friends. When we came back, we hit the traffic again because we couldn't get home without seeing the protests. And at this time, it seems like things have calmed down. So I'm like, okay, maybe just pull over and we'll join in a little bit. So we walk up, and a lot of these protests, I don't know if you guys have been, especially when they're like a little in mid-sized cities or big grassroots, they are a lot of fun. It's kind of like a hippie fest in a way, right? So there's people burning sage and music playing, there's families, and, you know, as a conscious Black person, I knew a lot of the people out there. So, you know, it's like, and we want to share love and empathy for each other and kind of console each other, right? So, you know, we're hugging and all these things. And then the night progressed a bit, maybe 30 minutes, and the police started to put yellow tape around us, like we were a crime scene. And I'm a storyteller, right? So I'm like, how is this story going to end? Nothing about it seemed right. And we were on East Avenue, which is an area where there are a lot of bars and things. So most of the people in the bars are white. And at the protest, there were white allies, and then there were Black people for the most part. So all the allies, when the police put the tape around us, they got around the edge. They became like a human border or shield so that they would be the ones that have the first contact with the police, understanding that Black people are more likely to be victimized by police brutality than they are, right? So they literally put themselves between us and the police started dragging them all the way and arresting them. So eventually it was only Black people left. And that's when things started to escalate. So in my mind, I'm like, okay, we got to get more white people down here. So I start to talk to, because, you know, I like to think that I'm charming, right? So I start to talk to the white people who are these outdoor balconies just watching us like we're like fish in your tank, right? So I'm like, don't you see what's happening? Do you agree? Did you see this video of this man being murdered? Please come down. Please join us. Please join us. As I'm doing that, my ex is behind me, and he's a big guy. He's 6'3", like 200 pounds. So he's talking to them as well. And then he starts to get in little squabbles with them. So I tell him, like, okay, I don't think that's really your talent, but let's just leave. Let's just leave. So as we turn to walk around, I'm in front of him. He's behind me. Four police officers just grabbed him and threw him to the ground. I don't know if I've ever been more afraid in my life. So I just started praying at the top of my lungs. And afterwards, when it was all done, he's like, I knew they were kicking me, but I didn't feel it. The only thing I could hear was you praying. And so they arrest him. And then I go back with the crowd. And now the strength of my ancestors, the strength of Christ, I'm just quiet because I'm watching the children. Because I told you guys, it was like a family scene 30 minutes prior. I'm watching children take off their hoodies and t-shirts and douse them with water and wrap them around their face, preparing for tear gas. So I can't leave. I can't leave. I can't leave my people, right? So the cops just start arresting, like they're just arresting everybody. Like, so we were kind of like ranked. So all the white people are gone, and they just line by line, they're just arresting everybody. So I just have my hands up and I'm just praying the whole time. And I can see the officer's like name. And so I'm praying for him. I'm praying for his family. I'm praying like this event, this moment to crystallize something in his awareness. So when he goes to handcuff me, he says, I'm going to put these on as loose as I can. And I say, okay. So as we're walking up, he's like, what makes you different than them? And I'm like, what do you mean? He's like, they're so angry. They're belligerent. And I said, I'm just as angry. But I know that if I were to show my humanity and have a human expression of anger, you would no longer be able to see me as a human. So that's why I'm not. And I'm like, did you see that video? Do you agree? And he's like, I don't agree with you guys being out here. I have to tell you the truth. And I said, I just pray one day that you will. So we ended up on this big paddy wagon, which wasn't a paddy wagon. It was actually a converted school bus because they arrested over 90 people that night, including two African-American journalists who were just there to be journalists, right? With the camera crews were arrested. It was just mass chaos. When we got to the tombs or booking, and I have to say also that my brother at the time was a police officer in that same police force, the same police force that has, again, drawn national criticism. So some of these officers I actually knew, but when it's times like this, lines get drawn and they chose their tribe over the people that they're supposedly there to protect and serve. When we were in booking, they ask you, like, what's your highest level of education? And I'm like, a master's. And the cop was like, oh, really? Yes, really? And I'm like, what about you? And he's like, master's criminal justice. I'm like, oh, okay. He's like, yeah, I teach at MCC, which is a community college in Rochester. I said, me too.
Really?
Yeah, really. Then when they're calling my ex and I by last name, we both keep saying who. They're like, wait, you're married? Yeah, we get married too. So fast forward to 4 years now with what's going on in Rochester. I'm excited to see an opportunity for reform. But yeah, challenges can definitely be scary. And when we challenge the system, which is what all patriots do, right? That's the legacy that we've inherited with the forefathers that we are taught to exalt. So when we do those things, often you put your life and your physical safety in jeopardy.
Yeah, I can hardly speak. That's such a powerful story. And of course, you know, Houston just went through the George Floyd murder, and which fortunately I can say didn't happen here, but the response to it. And I hope with you that there is reform happening. I hope that people are becoming aware. I think of what you said about the policeman who said, I don't agree with you. And I look at how the football players used to take a knee, and this was, you know, just blown up everywhere. I think the vice president actually got up and left a game. And now the whole team takes a knee. And I hope that it's not a passing fancy, that it's a reality of realizing that there is racism in this country and it is evil and it's tearing us apart, and it will continue to do so if we don't do something about it. That's quite a story. And I'm glad you told it, because since George Floyd, I've been trying to find a storyteller who can bring that story to life for us, for all of us out here. So, challenges come in many ways. Some are scary. I'm just curious, were the charges dropped the next day? That happened right away.
No, so we were charged with, because we had blocked the street, so it was like trespassing and obstruction of justice. So a lot of attorneys in Rochester, they volunteered their legal services. So, you know, my charges, I ended up finding an attorney pro bono, and my charges ended up getting dropped. But it was like, you know, contingent upon, you know, I think a year of not getting another arrest and things like that. And then my ex, he actually had to pay over $1,500 for the attorney. And then his charges were dropped too, but he had more contingencies. And both of us had never been arrested before. But you kind of see the difference even between how Black men and Black women are treated.
Right, right. Yes. Okay. I don't want to take away from the meaning of that moment. But if we pivoted again, some challenges are painful. I think that was a painful challenge. And other challenges are
amicable.
Yes, amicable, or build character, or teach you something about other people. Shall we pivot to another type of challenge?
Yes, we shall. Because I haven't told that story in a very long time. So even in reliving that moment, yeah, so.
Yes, I. And I think about the people who, and it's hard to leave that story, but I think about the people who surrounded you to protect you and how they were stripped away.
Right.
It's a terrible thing. I'm proud of Houston in that when when they had the march for the family, that when I attended, that it was peaceful, that our chief of police, Art Acevedo, I don't always agree with him, but he was there. There was a symbolism. It was a symbol to say, enough is enough. This was wrong. I'm not going to side with the police just because I'm a policeman and they're a policeman. That was wrong.
Well, right. He's a politician. He's very diplomatic. Because we see in less than 2 weeks, they approved their increase of the police budget. So there was no room or time. People were just asking for a stall in that vote, you know, so that the community could kind of think of alternative methods beyond additional policing. And we know that Houston HPD, they have their own pending cases with missing body cam footage. So I think that reform is definitely, and not to trivialize the symbols, because symbols are important, right? Like the NFL or NBA embracing certain things, people taking knees, people saying the right things, but we haven't felt the action of reform yet.
Right. Correct.
But yes, let's just move on.
Okay. I wish the audience could see you because you have an incredibly engaging smile.
Thank you.
So let's hear a pivot. We'll pivot to another challenge.
Yes. Another challenge. So, like I said, I was married to my best friend, but the life choices we've each wanted was not conducive to us staying together, right? So I'm newly single and ready to mingle since I've been in Houston. I actually took a year off of dating because I just wanted to figure myself out first. And, you know, I was so invested in my artistic journey and growth. I didn't want any distractions to that. But in the last 2 years, you know, I've been out here with pandemic and quarantine. That kind of put a damper on dating. But now that things have reopened, you know, looks to be, you know, safely and cautiously, I've been putting my foot out there a little bit. So on August 11th, I released my latest novel called New Black, and I'll get to that later. But at the release, and we did like small sessions of socially distanced, it was so fly, so dope. And for the white listeners, which most of you are, fly and dope. Okay, that means it was so interesting. It was so aesthetically pleasing. Okay, so the opening question at these sessions was, what's one of your favorite books? And somebody answered with The Alchemist. Now, that book is always on, you know, everybody's favorite list. I've been seeing it for years. Whenever I ask a question, I get that response. And as an English teacher or a former English teacher, I've literally seen the text, but something about the cover, the size of it, I thought, is this a children's book? I never opened it. At that event, I'm like, why? Why do people always say The Alchemist? And the young man responded, and he said, it teaches you how to turn into gold. And I was like, okay, that's a book recommendation. All right. And it does. I've read it 3 times in the last month. Okay. It's incredible. So anyway, so it's all about, you know, heeding the omens. Like, it just teaches you things you already know, but it gives it new language so that it kind of revitalizes in your spirit. All right. So this particular day I had, wrote a poem for a client, like their father had recently passed, and I wrote a poem for them. I had this place in New York City called me about a potential contract, like things are feeling good. I went to cook something for myself and I'm like, something in my gut said, take yourself out, celebrate a little bit, go for a late lunch, early dinner. And if you know me, I am a foodie. Like, my definition of success is being able to go to any restaurant I want and order whatever I want off the menu. Once I hit that pinnacle, I'm good. Okay. So I'm like, yeah, I'm good. I'm going to have some good food. Go out to this beautiful, I think it's a Colombian restaurant downtown. You know, walk in, you know, showing it. I like to show my clavicle, you know, I'm feeling good. Sit by the bar and I'm like, before I left the house, actually, I said, I'm going to meet somebody and they're going to pay for my meal. All right. So I'm just sitting at the bar with my Alchemist book, just minding my own business. And this guy comes in and I see him out the corner of my eyes, you know, broad shouldered, you know. I like black men, dark skin. I'm like, okay, all right. But I'm so enthralled in my book that I don't even pay him any attention. So eventually he asked me, what's good here, yada, yada, yada. So I'm answering him, you know, I'm giving him like the little flirt to the side, but then I'm right back to my book. So eventually I said, listen, I have one chapter left. Like, I'll be with you, sir. Just occupy yourself. So he's watching a game. I read my book, finish, and we hit it off. He's like, when the check comes, he's telling me, oh, your card doesn't work here. Let me take it. I'm like, I knew that was going to happen. You're absolutely right. When I'm ready to leave, I'm like, I'm going to go to, and I'm not sure the exhibit is still running at the Museum of Fine Houston, but Soul of a Nation is this incredible exhibit about the Black arts movement. It's so powerful. So I was going to go see it for a second time. And he's like, I'm coming with you. Okay, that sounds like a good idea to me. We get to the museum, and the museum is free on Thursday, so I don't have to go on my purse at all, neither does he. But at one point, I look in my wallet, and I had actually forgotten my debit card. So if he had not been there, I would have been washing dishes. I don't know what would have happened, right? So I'm like, that's heeding the omens. That's another good sign. So when we're going to leave, he's like, let's go out tonight. Why not? He takes me out. We have a good time. In the morning, he calls me. He's like, do you want to take a road trip? Now, a major part of The Alchemist is this caravan that he takes through the desert as he's trying to find his treasure, right? This dream, this vision he's had in his life. And being out on the open road, so to speak, really allowed him to engage with his heart and with the spirit of the universe. It was just this powerful moment. And so now, after reading this book, after having these good omens of, you know, business, creative, getting paid well to do what I love, right, which is to write for others. And then I meet this guy who pays for a meal when I don't have my card. And so now he's asking me to essentially take a caravan. What do I say? Sure, why not? So he's like, okay, I have to be to Greensboro for work on Monday. You can ride with me to Atlanta, or you can come all the way to Greensboro. Let's see. Maybe you'll be sick of me by then. And in my mind, I'm thinking, yeah, most likely I will be. So yeah, let's stick to Atlanta. We get on the road, and it was, I mean, I love a road trip, especially when I don't have to drive. His taste in music, hilarious. He's a Trump supporter, so we have some differences. But hey, He could articulate why. I'm not here to judge. We're mostly having fun, listening to music, acting crazy. We get to New Orleans, or we get to Louisiana. I say, have you ever been to New Orleans? He's like, no. You guys know what New Orleans is known for, right? Food. What do I love? Food. So, of course, we have to stop. We stop there. He doesn't eat the food. He only eats Nigerian food. A lot of Nigerians are like that. No problem. As long as you're paying for me to eat, no problem. Great. Okay. So yeah. So we leave the restaurant where only I ate and drank. And then we walk the streets a bit, which you all know, New Orleans with the narrow streets, it's so quaint and romantic. And because of the pandemic, it's not disgustingly overcrowded. I did not smell vomit nor urine. So there are some perks to this pandemic now. We get back to the hotel, and it thankfully has two beds in the room. And I'm like, awesome. Like, this guy gets it. So as I'm putting my stuff down on the bed, go take a shower, and I come out, he's in the bed where I put my stuff. So I'm literally scratching my head, like, why would you do that? And he's just basically starts his entitled rant as to, of course we're going to have sex. And I'm like, no, we're not. Simmer down there, tiger. So he handles his disappointment fairly gracefully. I go to sleep with one eye open. I ended up having food poisoning from that New Orleans food, which he did not eat, but that's a whole nother story. And then in the morning after, you know, I've been up vomiting and doing another bodily action all night. Not the bodily action he was hoping for, but another one, right? That only requires one person. But I guess the other one sometimes only requires one person too, but that's another topic. So in the morning, he starts explaining why his viewpoint, and just like on the Trump issue, I could understand where he was coming from. I don't agree. And he's like, no problem. When we get to Atlanta, he's like, we're adults. I'm a grown man. I don't sleep in the same hotel room with somebody and not have sex. I'm like, there's two beds. He's like, no, no, no. So we're in Atlanta. I'm going to get two hotel rooms so we won't have this issue. Okay, great. So we get back on the road, another day of music and laughter and lighthearted fun and silence and clouds and horizons and, you know, the infinite possibilities that the open road makes possible. We get to Atlanta. We hang out with one of his friends, actually a few of his friends, at this like Nigerian hookah spot. Lots of fun. When we're checking into the hotel, he's checking into one room. Now, I don't mind this because I like to be, you know, somewhat fiscally minded, even though it's not my money. Why get two rooms when we're literally only sleeping here and we're going to be gone in the morning? So when he gets one room, I don't mind. But when the clerk asks him, oh, so do you want a king or a double? And he's like, oh, it doesn't matter. And I'm like, ha ha! It does matter, sir. We need two beds. Make it a double. He did not talk to me the rest of the evening. In the morning, our agreement, now fortunately, he already paid for my ticket from Atlanta back to Houston, right? Which was the agreement. In the morning, he was supposed to take me to the airport and then get on the road to go the rest of the way to Greensboro. Now he's sleeping. We know this fake sleep, right? I'm like, okay, it's time for me to go to the airport. He rolls over and feigns a snore. And so I Uber, and that was the last sound I heard from my caravan mate. The Uber cost me $30, so not a bad investment.
Oh, so yes, we've gone from Black Lives Matter to the Me Too movement.
Right. All in a day.
Oh, yeah, you've covered them both. Yes, yes. So there is something called being with somebody and having a good time with somebody and not having to have sex with somebody to, you know, to seal that.
Friendship, right.
You know?
Exactly.
Well, but you dealt with that challenge.
I normally do.
I presume you have not heard from him since then.
I have not.
Well, we're going to take a moment here for station identification.
This is Mary Edgerton with my guest, Banke Awupatu, telling stories about challenges right here on So What's Your Story, only on Pacifica, KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston, or live streaming at kpft.org. So we've been talking about challenges, and yes, the story world was challenged and answered right back with a pivot to virtual meetings. Let's start with the Houston Storytellers Guild because it's a great place to learn about the art of telling. They meet the fourth Tuesday of every month from 7 to 8:30 p.m. Actually, during COVID time, or as I like to call it, the era of Q, they've started holding virtual meetings. The next one is October 27th. But before that, looks like they're going to have the annual Skyline Screamers to be held October 22nd. And as of right now, it looks like that will be a live event at Marmion Park. So we're going to keep you posted on that. Definitely visit HoustonStorytellers.org for information about their upcoming story swaps. And while you're on the site, enjoy our past So What's Your Story programs listed on the menu under radio program. Good way to connect during the era of Q. And we have begun posting our most recently recorded shows. Don't miss any of our weekly programs. Not owning a radio is never a problem because you can listen to us live streaming on kpft.org. We have a Facebook page, and we're also on YouTube. So go find us. We're there, all over the place. And if you visit us on Facebook, please like us before you leave. Have some program ideas? Yes, maybe yourself? Let us know by dropping us a note at story@kpft.org. And we promise to get back to you. Now let's not forget our friends at The Moth, not at Warehouse Live, but also having virtual slams. They just had one recently, but here's some more news. Our very own guest host, Eric Heen, will be competing in the Grand Slam Central, a virtual Grand Slam across multiple major cities in the U.S. on September 30th. Our guest host, Chris Gorman, competed in the last one. So you better get your tickets now before they sell out, because they do sell out. So go to themoth.org/Grand Slam Central and get a household ticket. And now, let's get back to So What's Your Story with Banke Awupatu.
Okay, so we're back now. Now, Banke, you mentioned before that you're a writer and was it your first novel? But you had a novel that just came out in August. Tell us a little bit about the story of Bonke as a writer.
Yes. So my latest novel is called New Black, and it is available exclusively on Bonke, B-A-N-K-E, the author.com. My whole life, I have been a storyteller. I was the last born in my family. Like I said, a natural introvert. So I remember as a child, so many moments where I could hear my parents, my siblings, like, "Where's Banks?" That's the family nickname. "Where's Banks? Where's Banks?" And I would be under the stairs hiding because I just liked that vantage point of being able to hear them, but they didn't know where I was, right? So as they're walking up and down, I can hear snippets of conversation. I guess I was kind of like voyeuristic in a way that I just love to be able to collect other people's stories, right? So from a child, whenever somebody would ask, "What do you want to be when you grow up?" I always said a writer. I've always known. I would spend hours just making up stories in my mind. I wasn't really into Barbies, but my older sisters were. And I would have like these sagas with these characters, right? And I would pick them up each day. Like, okay, what's the next chapter? When I graduated from the University of Virginia, I majored in theater and African and African American studies. And my parents were like, "What are you going to do with that?" I didn't know. I just knew that I wanted to know all about Black history from a pan-African global standpoint. Everything that had been deprived in traditional education settings, I wanted to know about the history, the legacy, the accomplishments, the spirituality of my people. And as a theater major, I wanted to know how to tell stories. And I was really into hip hop journalism. I was a senior writer for the university paper. I wrote for different hip hop websites. Like, that was my thing. But when I graduated, the introvert in me could not find the courage and the gumption to go after writing full time. And so I moved back home to Rochester and I started teaching. And that definitely was a passion of mine because, again, I'm very community-minded. I wanted to share with students coming from the same impoverished district that I graduated from the possibilities that were out there, and then also their true history. Because it is my understanding and my belief that if a person understands their personal history in regards to their family, their ancestors, as well as their racial history, where they come from, it just will instill a level of confidence that will help to erode some of these social issues that we have. And so that was my life. But at 25, I had a quarter life crisis and I'm like, this is not what I wanted to do. Like, I remember I wanted to be a writer. And so I wrote my first novel, Always Want More. And it took 3 years because I was working as an English teacher full time. And when I tell you I was dedicated, like when I got married, so many of my students were there and my ex in the vows, he's like, "I love how you love your kids." And so when I went back to work, they were like, "Oh, you never told us you had kids." And I'm like, "He's talking about y'all." The novel took me 3 years because of, you know, just with the time constraints. And then I spent another 3 years querying to agents, every agent in the Western Hemisphere. I sent at least 300 pitches, right? And I got about a dozen very nice no's. People saying, like, "You're really onto something, but I don't know how to market this." And what they did not know how to market was an authentic Black story, a story that could be set in Rochester, New York. A story that would have crime and hood tells, you know, kind of like this the typical inner city saga that you would see spliced with Black history, anecdotes about Black literature, have characters who are educated in the setting. They weren't used to that. They were used to one or the other. They were used to typically the books you see if you go into the, you know, the urban fiction or African-American fiction section of any bookstore or Walmart, which is all these like prison stories, basically like Baby Mama Drama Part 3, those type of stories, or they were used to Toni Morrison. They weren't used to that middle ground, which that's me. That's my style as a writer because I love hip hop. I love a good hood story. I love crime. I love drama. I love a fast pace. My first job was at 14 at a library. So, like I said, I've been writing and reading my whole life. So I'm very influenced by Mary Higdon Clark. I love all that stuff. And I also love substance. So that was a very long answer to say that's the story of me as a writer.
Always want more. So has it been published?
Yeah, I made my own publishing company. You know me, Mary. I'm going to do it myself if it needs to get done.
Like your first story, your show.
Yes. Yes, for sure. And then with Always Want More, in the first year, we sold over 1,000 copies. Now, that doesn't sound that impressive. But if you know the book market, you know that only 3% of authors will sell more than 1,000 copies. And from there, that opened because the book was about a teacher in that district. I got media coverage from every local publication. I've been featured in Women's Health. I've been featured in Ebony. Now, these are national publications, right? And then I actually ended up getting hired by that same district. They were like, okay, so you have so much to say. Let's see if you can help. So they hired me because they needed a new code of conduct to disrupt the school to prison pipeline. And you guys know that phenomenon. Like if you're suspended, and most, if you're a Black student, you're more likely to be suspended. And if you're suspended, you're more likely to end up in prison. And a lot of the suspensions, the same way with the criminal justice system, are these subjective infractions like insubordination. Me, myself, as a student, I was long-term suspended. So when I was applying for colleges, I had to check that box, like as if you're a felon, right? You have to check the box about a long-term suspension. So I had navigated all of that. And so they needed somebody who could come in and help them get this new code of conduct that they had been fighting for 3 years with community input to district-wide, one, to be approved, and then two, to be adopted. And I did that. So my life is a challenge.
About you is I ask you a question and you tell me a story. You are a storyteller. Can you read us a chapter from one of your books, the new one?
I certainly am. So I'm going to hold it up to the camera. I don't know if the video of this will ever be used, but why not?
Okay, The New Black.
New Black.
I wouldn't say The New Black. It's New Black.
New Black. I think about my mother every day. Some days I can't remember what she looked like. When I see her face, I'm not sure if it's from my actual memory or from a picture. A captured moment that can never completely capture the moment. See, that was almost poetic. My mother used to read poetry to me. Paul Laurence Dunbar, James Weldon Johnson, Maya Angelou. As I got older, I read this short story she left lying around. See, I have this thing where I have to read everything I see. It's really annoying sometimes. I can't get off the train until I read every posting. If it's a short trip, then I gotta read fast. My mother peeped this, so she left messages around. James Baldwin's Sunny Blues effed me up. Those boys now were living as we'd been living then. They were growing up with a rush and their heads bumped abruptly against the low ceiling of their actual possibilities. What were my actual possibilities? My mother had her house set up like the Cosbys. Black art, passports, black books, season tickets to the theater, museum memberships, exotic foods, all paid for by pain. When I was 9, Harvey asked me to make a run with him. X, want to ride to the game with me? Anytime my father or brothers talked about taking a ride, it meant they were going to pick up some money. My mother was in a whole different room, but yelled, pardon? Oxford, would you care to accompany me to watch the SciEd final? He winked at me. Bad grammar was the easiest way to distract my mother. When we were a block away from the house, he rolled the window down and turned the radio up. Looking at the front door blasted, Harvey was leaned back in his seat, doing 100 easy on Grand Central Parkway. I leaned back in my seat too, sat up when we got to 41st Street. Harvey parked and a skinny kid in big jeans hopped in the back seat. He ducked down.
ain't safe to go to the stash right now. I didn't even know if you were still coming. Why not? You ain't hurt? Hector shot up a playground. Cops been out wilding like crazy. DT's all over the place. Harvey looked in the rearview mirror. They been up at the schools too? Nah. How old are your little brother? 7. Walk him to school in the morning. Stop at the stash. Put it in his book bag. I'll meet you up at the school. Bet. The skinny kid got out and we drove away. Do you think any kids got killed? What? At the playground. Oh. Harvey shrugged. I don't know. Who's Hector? That works for us. Used to anyway. That kid runs for him. You ever put stuff in my book bag? Of course not. I sat next to my mother at a guest lecture at Columbia. Dr. Assad, a world-renowned genealogist and psychologist, was tall and lean, with licorice-colored skin and salt and pepper dreads. She looked like wisdom herself. Why revisit these traumas? Because the memory of them is embedded in our DNA, and our brains have fashioned adaptive strategies that are as crippling as they are effective. There's a beauty in that paradox, which I have termed split, snap, shatter. Dr. Assad took long strides across the stage. Split begins in childhood. Consider the child ripped from her family because a CPS worker is more comfortable issuing a home removal than talking to her Black mama. This is compounded by the historical trauma, the genetic memory of being sold away. This is too much for the brain to bear, so the nervous system steps in and lays a blanket of opiates over the mind, which produces a numbing effect. The emotion essentially splits off. If the trauma is repeated or unaddressed, the emotions are buried by thicker layers of opiates, which create a lack of empathy, which is the precursor for violence that corrodes our communities. SNAP is common in both children and adults. Imagine split as ice. SNAP is the fire. SNAP is triggered by conditions that mirror the original trauma. A man's cologne can remind a woman of the scent of her rapist. Someone's speaking voice sounds similar to robbers who kick down the door. The ego snaps, breaks off from all reasoning and logic, rages into a fight or flight response. Lastly, there's shatter. This occurs when the mind is exposed to a horror that it cannot withstand. It instead shatters, departs into a fantasy world of hallucinations and voices. We know this commonly as schizophrenia. She paused and looked into the faces of the crowd. Dr. Rasai's eyes stopped on mine as she tapped her long fingers together before speaking again. Most experts end the discussion here. They present the deficit, the illness, but fail to highlight the protective effects. My life's work is spreading the perspective that they would like to suppress. It's a message of empowerment that is rooted in the science, the historical, and the spiritual. Black Americans are spawn of the first humans, the greatest contributor to civilization, to math and science, the creators of the world. We are direct descendants of those bred for resiliency, those who survived the longest and cruelest bondage in human record and would have eclipsed their oppressors within one generation, if not for continuous systemic opposition, and yet still managed to amass staggering accomplishments. You don't have to be a Darwinian to deduce that we are the fittest. Yes, our minds are bruised, but we are endowed with a spirit that this world, despite its best efforts, can never extinguish.
So let me buy a copy and have you sign it. And I actually have one of Toni Morrison's books signed by her. I knew her cousin. And I'll put yours next to it.
That's all right. That's great company.
Yes, yes. So you told us a little bit about how you got into storytelling. I love that, hiding under the stairs, listening to the story evolve around you as the listener. How did you find the moth? here in Houston.
Right. So in the 3 years that I've been here, right, and talking to everybody and going everywhere, I made a friend, a young man named, I keep saying young man, I'm 36 and I started teaching at 21. So anybody in their 20s, I just put young in front of their name. I definitely date myself doing that. But a friend of mine, his name is Ashra, and he knows that I perform. He came to my show, Queen. And so he hit me that day and he's like, oh, there's this event. Get your ticket. Hurry up. It's going to sell out. And I'm like, okay. Now, mind you, at the time, I was teaching full time. I was teaching special ed here in Houston Independent School District. I had to take a day gig. I needed some extra funds, right? So when I get this text, it's in the middle of my workday. I don't even really have time to, like, so I just follow the link. I see that it's like $18 or something to go. And then when I see what it is, storytelling challenge, I'm like, well, if I'm paying, I'm the only one to go. I want to tell the story. You know, I like the mouth, right? And so I just was like, okay, challenge. I'm not going to write a story because one, I don't have time. I'm at work. And two, you put your name in a hat and they pick it out. So you don't know if you're ever going to make the stage. I didn't want to write something and not know if I was going to have a chance to present it. And so when I got there and it's Warehouse Live and it's so, like, it's filled to the rafters, I'm like, yo, I gotta make it on stage. I was the last person's name who went in the hat. The hat wasn't even out anymore. I had to summon somebody, like, excuse me, sir, you come here. And so, and like I said, I didn't know what it was. I had never been there. I didn't even sit with my friend because it was so packed. We had to kind of like split up. And I listened to your story. I listened to a few other storytellers. And I was like, oh, this crowd, they like a funny story. Okay, I could be funny. And I just started piecing together what I would say. I knew I would tell the real life story, right? Because all of them are supposed to be real, about putting my show together. But then I just figured out where the dramatic or comedic flourishes would be. And then they called me up and I won.
Yeah. Well, our hour's coming to an end. It's really been great. And we used to put some of our shows up on Facebook Live. I don't know if I can post a recording there, but I'd like everybody out in Radio Land to just imagine the wonderful, wonderful smile that Bonke has, because it is a wonderful smile and it would make your day if you saw it. Thank you for being here. And
I have to plug myself again, if you don't mind, something I have learned. Please visit BonkeTheAuthor.com. The ebook is actually completely free. So this story, New Black, you can download the ebook for free. And if you are like me and Mary and you like to actually turn the pages and smell it, and you would like a signed copy, and not only is it signed, but I write a personal message in each one. The paperbacks I'm selling for $100. It's very ballsy, ladies and gentlemen. It's not for the weak, all right? So if you just want to preview it to see if it's worth $100, download the ebook. You can read the whole book for free. And when you love it, which you will, go back and buy the paperback for $100, because I am a Black and independently owned publishing house. I have decided to cut all third parties out. They're completely problematic. Everything comes from me, the source, and everything is top notch. Because I'm a winner.
You are. Wonderful, wonderful. Okay, well, thank you.
Thank you.
Now, don't you dare move, because Lars is up next with a sweet mix of singer-songwriters on the Tennyson Tapes. Make 90.1 a part of every day, and while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling, join us every Thursday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story? And treasure what you hear. Keep loving great stories, and we'll keep bringing them to you. This is Dr. E, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we never want you to forget that it's never too late to live happily ever after. Peace.
KPFT is seeking programming of all kinds for our new streaming channel. From music to talk, we want it all. Whether you're a seasoned veteran or a novice, we'd love to hear your big idea. If you're a local podcaster or know one, here's a chance to move from digital to FM. KPFT's web streaming channel replicates on our FM channel, so your idea needs to adhere to language and other policies mandated by the FCC. These projects also need to be non-commercial in nature. Interested? Just visit kpft.org and click on the Propose a Show tab towards the bottom of our front page. Multilingual programming is also welcome. Again, just visit kpft.org for details. This is 90.1 KPFT Houston.
Every day in America, tens of thousands of people are trafficked, bought, sold, and sexually exploited. Demand Abolition is committed to eradicating the illegal commercial sex industry in the U.S. and, by extension, the world. By combating the demand for purchased sex, Demand Abolition insists an inherent human right is that no person can be bought or sold. Sex buyers or johns drive the illegal sex trade. Without their money,